Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate y'all joining us for another edition of Midrats. And I always want to put out an invitation to that esteemed cohort that is blessing us with your presence live. We've already got Paul and NEC there in the chat room at the bottom of the show page. If you are so inclined today, join in the chat room. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show, and it especially gets a lot of play on episodes like today. We've got the world-famous Midrats free-for-all format. That means we have the ideas and issues that we want to talk about, but depending upon our mood at the moment, we may have an open up mind to take what your concerns are. So if you have some observations or some topics you're interested in us considering, please put in the chat room. Or if you are really feeling extroverted, we always like to invite people to see that phone number for the studio. It's right there on the show page. You can call us at area code 347-308-8397, and it's right there on the show page. We would love to hear from you. So, hey, Eagle One, good afternoon.
Hey, Sal, how you doing? How you doing?
Well, after a 2-week break, as you pointed out during the pre-show, we managed to press all the buttons correctly. So, at least as far as I could tell, we are alive.
Yeah, it's always a good thing when you wake up and you're still breathing.
It is. Well, you know, even though we take a 2-week break, it's funny. We've done back-to-back melees and free-for-alls. I'm not sure what the difference is between the two. Maybe I just use different words. But there's always a lot going on the naval side of the world. And I guess if you wanted to, you know, pick some of the bold-faced items of some things that those, especially inside the Beltway, like to talk about is what do the important people think are important. There's a little bit of intro reading that goes on here, and you know we always see little flashbacks, but both the SECNAV and the Navy and the CBO with their commentary on the Navy's 30-year shipbuilding plan came out to give kind of some higher direction and guidance, higher intent. What kind of tapped you on the shoulder the most out of that grouping?
Well, I thought that the NAVSEC, Mr. DeToro's strategic guidance to the Navy was somewhat funny in the sense that it always reminds me of this opening of the $6 million man, if you remember that show, that, you know, that the astronaut gets basically blown up in some kind of accident, and they say, well, we can build it, building back bigger, stronger, faster. You know, I mean, that's the way this thing starts off. We're going to rebuild the fleet. It's going to be great. We'll have all kinds of cool things, and you know, one of the ways they plan to do that is, as far as I can tell, is by going through the drill we've gone through before. We're going to, as I think Terry Hendricks has said, we're going to divest to invest. We're going to get rid of these old ships we don't need that won't work right and can't maintain them. And then down the road, we'll build these wonderful ships to replace them, and we'll have the money because we all know the money's going to always be there. And that just strikes me as being silly. And there's other stuff. I mean, you have always loved the word garbage that comes out sometimes, but I love this one. This one is talking about enhancing warfighting readiness. We will integrate and streamline our combined logistics apparatus and supply chains to ensure constant readiness throughout the fleet and FMF. We will redirect savings toward transformative modernization wherever possible to enhance future and long-term readiness. I have no idea what that means, and I don't see anywhere that there's been necessarily a specific way that you can do any of that. Only if you don't know what it means, how are you, what are your markers to how you'll know when you get there?
It was reductive words. I agree. I didn't expect a lot. It was disappointing. Now, the one thing that I came away from, and I'll just do a little quote here. This is a quote from the speech, and then people understand why I'll say what I say. Quote, "We have to fight on every front," he said, "on space, cyber, on land, on sea, under the sea, above the sea, everywhere. It takes all those efforts collectively for us to be successful." The third strategic goal is empowering people, Del Toro said. He is focused on increasing educational opportunities for sailors in the service. His strategic plan calls for more investments in the U.S. Naval War College and the Naval Postgraduate School. End quote. Anybody here on MIDRATS can rewind to 2017, 2018, where we interviewed some people in the previous administration. It's like the same speechwriters went in, had AI produce the random SecNav speech and pressed entered, and that what came out. Yeah, there's a little bit of extra flavoring here and there. But if people, and maybe it's fair, the new SecNav is a background in Democrat fundraising and you know, he was a surface warfare officer. Good for him. He's still trying to figure out the job, and he had to give a speech, and this is something that, you know, he's not committing to anything new, anything special. I don't think that he is one of these John Layman types who is coming in and is going to bend things to his will. I think he's one of those guys that's going to come in, try to figure out what he can do, and try to make it happen. I think he's a well-meaning person. He's very talented. He knows a lot of the politicians, may be able to squeeze out an extra billion bucks or two, but there's really nothing new here, and I didn't detect any strong personality from him. ... The downside to that is that means the permanent, to use my pejorative term, nomenclatura inside of D.C. that has been making policy and has been making priorities and has been trying to clutch together a fleet for the last two decades plus are the ones that's going to be pushing, that's going to be in control, that's going to drive ideas. And the old cliche that we love to say, to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result, is the definition of insanity. So I we'll get into it later, I guess, but there's some of the things that that was made about the latest 30-year shipbuilding plan that was just recycled. So I guess everybody, and the verbiage is there as well, you'll see pulled up now and then, everybody's trying to find out what somebody else is going to say and do so they can say and do it too, but nobody is saying or doing anything that's actionable. So I guess we're treading water.
Yeah, I mean, there is the point that is made in this strategic guidance that we want to expand our forward presence. You know, okay, how are we going to do that? You know, and when are we going to do that? Those are the issues that concern me right now. You know, I look at this, and I wrote about, actually, on that USNI blog about, if you're going to say that we want to give that the Australians are going to get nuclear subs, that's great, but 2040 is a long way away, and I don't see any reason why we couldn't speed that up. I would suggest, if we want a forward presence, that let's do it. Let's talk to the Australians. Let's talk to the people on Palau, you know, wherever else we can out there, and let's get our forces forward deployed someplace other than Japan, and just see if we can get and I'm glad we have Marines currently in Australia. But let's move this up. Let's keep pushing this. Let's get going. Let's not talk about it. Let's do it. And you can't do it by standing around going, well, you know, by 2019, I mean by 2049, we're going to have X. You need to, the timeline needs to be a lot shorter than this, especially for this administration. If they're serious about doing this stuff, let's get this thing moving rather than just yapping about it.
And that's the key. It's easy to talk, and the cynical amongst us would say there's billions of dollars to be made on theories, prototypings, and concepts that never displace water or make shadows on the ramp, while it's hard to make billions of dollars on things that actually do. And a lot of this, you know, it's too hard to do what you said. Because that's measurable, and math matters, and you can be really held accountable for that. But if you instead are talking and positioning money around for things that will either work or not a decade after you leave office, you can leave office with all the hosannas and praise in the world, and then somebody else will inherit your problems. And more faster with the Australian sub deal, I think is exactly right. And again, I don't know whether the rightest, best solution would be, or if they've even said which one it is, whether it's going to be a U.S. submarine or a British submarine design. But whichever one can move faster, I think is better. Japan is making a lot of moves towards increasing her capabilities. I think we saw this week also. I thought it was ironic because it was just kind of one of those throwaway things I found neat and interesting. And it got more traffic in the last 2 weeks than anything else. It's Japan back in the fixed-wing aviation on carriers, where they had U.S. Marine Corps F-35 Bravos from Iwakuni flying off of the Uzumo. I think the next one is Kaga. I love the fact they're bringing back their old carrier names. That is really good because Japan right now only spends 1% of her GDP on national defense, and she has an incredibly capable Navy. There has been some talks in the ruling party that they need to move closer to 2%. If they doubled their expenditures on the military, that'd be more than double Navy, because the Japanese, they appreciate more than we do. They are naturally a maritime and aerospace power, so the most of that increase would go towards naval and air assets, which if anything blew up in the West Pac and Japan decided to be a player, what a huge asset it would be, because not only would the Japanese bring a lot to the table, pound for pound, person for person, they are some of the most easily integrated and professional mariners out there, second only to the Anglosphere nations. So that was really neat. I think people got the significance of that. Yes, I know that they're small little carriers, and even within 10 years, they're not going to see much. But two Japanese mini carriers carrying 10 F-35 Bravos, helping to secure their corner of the ocean, means that we don't have to. So I thought that was really neat that at least in the national security arena, people that got a lot of eyes, whether just out of historical curiosity or an appreciation of the significance of the Japanese Navy getting back into the carrier business.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. And it also harkens back to what was it we had before, one of our strategies, the 1,000-ship Navy, where we're going to encourage our allies to and I see some of the allies stepping up. I think the Japanese, the Brits, obviously with their two new carriers, the Australians at least indicating a desire to get these fast attack subs. You know, I think these are good things, and there are a lot of other countries out there that would benefit from from some additional modernization of their equipage. The Vietnamese, certainly the Singapore has got a very modern small navy. Indonesia and Malaysia, you're never quite sure what they're going to do, but they've been, they're taking, at least complaining about the Chinese wandering into their territorial waters or their exclusive economic zones. So, that part of the world would be, but things would be a lot easier if the Filipinos would make up their mind as to whether they want us there or not, and if they do, how much they're willing to let us play in their country. I know that a lot of stuff from the pre-World War II and shortly thereafter world of our, when they were part of the American Commonwealth, probably maybe still lingers there too. But that's a really important country, and we have to also deal with what Taiwan is up to, because they're not going to go gently into the good night as this thing, if things unfold in an unfortunate way.
Yeah, I think you could see, at least from a distance, we gotta get somebody really smart on Taiwan on here to give us some visibility on what they're thinking. But you can see for a long time they were trying to, a lot of people were in the first decade and a half of this century trying to be nice to the Chinese and hoping that everything was going to be the Obama, we welcome the peaceful rise of China, etc. But as what Emperor Xi and his friends look like they want to do, that the Taiwanese realized they need to adopt. Well, I think we talked about this probably the first couple of years of the show, so almost a decade ago, the old porcupine theory. Taiwan needs to be the porcupine. They're small, but it needs to be more trouble than it's worth for the Chinese to go try to make that. And so that has that realization of what Chinese is. I think courage can be contagious, and you have to give a nod to the Australians, who the whole wolf warrior attitude that went in parallel with the outbreak of COVID. The Australians have shown some spine, and other nations are as well. And especially for the smaller nations, many that you mentioned, they are looking for strength. They're looking for friends and allies because they don't want to be left out or cornered. And that's something to watch. I don't know. I wouldn't bet small amounts of money that we're going to see anything there like we see in Europe. But I don't think we need to, because ultimately our advantage, even with hard allies and soft friends, is that united front can directly and indirectly encourage the other nations. Like, I got a big kick out of, I said, it's always fun to play around with friends. And there was a great picture. And I thought it was nice that the lead ship in the formation was the, I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly, the Issei, the Japanese little helicopter destroyer, not one of the ones that's been hardened for the F-35, leading U.S. Carl Vinson and the HMS Queen Elizabeth. And in that little formation that the Japanese Ministry of Defense put out, it wasn't just the Japanese and the Americans and the Brits, but you also had the New Zealanders, Canadians, the Dutch, and the Australian, all in formation, all six nations in formation together. The only thing that would make it even better would be if there was a Malaysian or an Indonesian there, or maybe an Indian, but you can't have a perfect world to take a good one. So I think the more that those nations show some resolve and we work together, the better it is for everybody, if for no other reason than it will not encourage the Chinese to push more. Like most bullies, they look for the soft, easy things to push around. And if we can have nations show that we're working together, that's great. Because one thing I've never seen, maybe it's been there, is I've never seen the Chinese Navy doing a formation and an exercise with six other nations. With the Russians, yeah, I've seen that. But that's about it. The Chinese don't have a lot of friends, and the Russians and the Chinese are just it's easier for them to be friends because they don't have any other friends. But that was another one of the encouraging things that I saw this week with all the problems and confusion that we and the and to be harsh, the lack of clear-eyed public discussion from the present Secretary of the Navy, and the confusion and the lack of vision that we saw in the 30-year shipbuilding plan, that there are things that the fleet and the Navy can do with our counterparts. That's a good counter message that, yep, things may not look clear. Things may not look as nice as they want to be. And yes, you know, it's only been less than 6 weeks since our humiliation in Afghanistan, however, we can still get together and operate together with you. You know, we're the United States. How you doing? Let's go exercise and do what we've always been able to do. So more of those exercises that we can do, and maybe because we have to concern ourselves less with flying overhead Afghanistan, having F-18s chase Toyota Corollas around the countryside, that we can invest more in building relationships and capabilities with everybody from Japan to Indonesia and everybody in between.
Yeah, and it would also be nice if our own people would quit trying to shoot us in the foot. I don't know if you saw this New York Post story about the nuclear engineer trying to sell confidential information about the Virginia-class submarines to somebody. Have you seen that thing?
No, I missed that, but yeah, it's my first take with people like that is well, we've all been through the security clearance process, and they always want to dig into your finances. But there's some people who do stuff like that because they got gambling problems or they have five ex-wives or something like that. Some of them, they like the danger. And there are some that do it even for espionage purposes. But people who do stuff like that, we need to make a public example of them. I don't know if we do a good enough job. And we all know what happened to Walker. But, yeah, if somebody's going to do something like that, the full force of the government needs to come down on these people, because that's not just giving away tens of billions of dollars of research for free. It can cost a lot of lives down the road, and we shouldn't play around with that.
Yeah, it was he was going cheap, though. I mean, he got $10,000 up front and another $20,000, so not exactly a high price deal. I mean, yeah, we've had enough problems in the past with this. We don't need another bozo doing this kind of thing. Well, you know, we got so many things to talk about. We should talk about Jerry Hendricks' great powers don't have shrinking navies. The sea power makes great powers thing in Foreign Policy magazine. Did you get a chance to read that?
I actually have a copy of it right in front of me. And we have Jerry in the chat room lurking. He's probably being very needy and going, talk about my article. I really like my article. Matter of fact, tonight I'm probably going to write a little post on it. And I want to tease Jerry most of all for going in Foreign Policy. But, you know, you can't publish just in one place all the time. You got to go into neutral territory, and sometimes you got to go into foreign territory, so to speak. And I think maybe that's one thing, you know, and by Jerry going to Foreign Policy, it's good in this regard. And we can see part of that, and we should probably talk later on about supply chain issues, but there are things that Sal Marcogliano, John Conrad, Mr. Ross, whose first name is slipping my mind all of a sudden, we had him on a few months ago, those that understand national trade, how it impacts maritime security and economic security, we all talk amongst ourselves. So we think everybody knows about this. But it's a busy world. There's a lot of important people that have a lot of things that they're focused on. And they only have, like we all do, so many hours a day to look into their information stovepipes? And if something, regardless of how important it is, doesn't show up in their information stovepipe, they're going to miss it. And before I even dove into the substance, and after I got through my initial snark, because I've had issues with foreign policy in the past, but that's okay. My third feeling, which I think was a more accurate feeling, is Jerry and others like him need to make an effort as much as possible to get these issues brought up in more venues, because kind of what we started off the show with Secretary Del Toro, great guy, he'll do the best he can, but for a variety of reasons, not going to be driving it, and Congress is about to be distracted here for an election year coming up. This is a long-term game, trying to get people to understand the fact that we are by design and by need, a maritime and aerospace power, just like Japan we talked a little bit about, and why that's important, how you can resource that, ways that you can leverage that and also secure that. And it's going to take a lot more than just the usual suspects that we know to appreciate that. It's going to have to get into the ear of people that the military itself, much less naval things, are maybe a third or fourth tier item. We've got to help them and their staffers and influencers to see it and to pull it. If we can't get it into a first tier item, at least get it in their scan as a second tier item, because it's not going to be 1 or 2 years to fix the focus that we've had for the last 2 decades with chasing Islamic terrorists all over the globe. It's going to take a while, and it's going to have to take smart people making good arguments in order to take that turn. So that's my little nod to the head to Jerry getting that in foreign policy. It's a shame that we can't, and there are a couple people in the Washington Post and the New York Times that write on national security issues, but I pull up the Washington Post online every morning because I'm a masochist, and it doesn't break above the background noise. So in the long term, if we can get people like Dave Larder to leave the aerospace industry and get picked up by a major newspaper to write and get maritime issues in front of more eyes, that'd be great. But in the interim, I think it's going to have to be the people we know that know how to write and communicate to get out there in these publications and get these issues in front of more eyeballs. So when moments arise that get extra attention, for instance, and I think we'll hear more coming up towards the holiday season, the supply chain issues, why you cannot buy things, that opens up the door to people who say, hey, somebody talked about our merchant fleet and why that isn't working. Let's go talk to these guys. It's in the background, in the back of their head.
Yeah, Sal Mercogliano's got this great YouTube site, which I put a link up to in the chat room. You know, he's got mostly short YouTube videos talking about things that are important to shipping. You know, the connection he doesn't make that I have seen in there is that part of what the reason that we have a Navy, and that Mahan was writing about that stuff, was because it was important to protect our merchant shipping and to, you know, provide access to the sea, not just for our ships and more recently for the rest of the shipping of the world, which is why it's important that we have a Navy. So that these things are all tied together. And, you know, I don't necessarily think the other Sal wants to get into discussing great naval thinking. But, you know, it is important to note that these things are connected, that our shipping, merchant shipping, is important, and we don't have enough of it. And it's, as people are beginning to notice, I saw it on another article recently where, you know, people were talking about what happens if you don't have a way to ship your goods, and what happens when you need to support things like, oh, I don't know, an army located a couple thousand, 3,000, 5,000 miles away.
Yeah, and I think part of it too is we need to be comfortable with being very direct. I think there are too many times that we are too polite with other people's incorrect ideas. And that's one of the things that when I was reading Jerry's article that I got real excited about, because it gets in my crawl on a regular basis. I'm going to quote Jerry a little bit. Quote, "The overarching U.S. naval strategy stated repeatedly by defense leaders during this spring's round of congressional hearings is to, quote, divest, unquote, of older platforms in order to, quote, invest, unquote, in newer platforms that, though fewer in number, would possess a qualitative edge over those fielded by competitors. As history reveals, this strategy will produce a fleet too small to protect the United States' global interest or win its wars, period, end of extended quote." Yes, that's Jerry's very polite way of saying you're wrong, history shows you're wrong, and I'm going to tell you you're going to wrong. Let me tell you what's right. And we need more direct conversation like that, because there's some smart people in good locations that know a lot, but a lot of what they know is just wrong.
Yeah, as I said, if you decommission a bunch of VLS tubes and you don't have a replacement on hand, you just shot yourself in the foot. And I don't care if those ships, as I've already said, if they were stuck in the mud near Dunbarton Bridge and San Francisco Bay, they're still an asset that has some capability to do something. And it makes no sense. And, most of us have a rule in our families that if you're going to buy a new piece of furniture, you don't get rid of the old piece of furniture until the new one arrives, right? You don't. It just doesn't make any sense to buy a new couch, attempt to buy a new couch, but first throw out your old couch and then have nothing to sit on for a while. And this is just the same thing. Why do you you need ships? You know you already don't have enough ships, and your theory is somehow you're going to save money by not keeping these older ships while you're building these new ones, which will be available. And Lord knows our production of ships seems to take forever, but 5-10 years down the line, that makes no sense. You can maintain older ships even if you put them in very limited roles a lot longer than that. And also, I think there's a lot of magical thinking about how these unmanned, and Lord knows I like the unmanned programs, but how these unmanned platforms are going to do wonders for us. Unmanned platforms have their place, but they are not the same thing as having a fully manned destroyer with unmanned escorts going in harm's way somewhere.
Yeah, I call them the exquisite assumptions. And the Congressional Budget Office, back at the end of September, put out an analysis of the Navy's fiscal year 2022 shipbuilding plan. And I used up about half of a pen's worth of ink marking it up. But right off the bat, and I gotta give some credit where credit is due, there's some pretty nice shade that they've thrown the Navy's way. And basically, there are two little assumption A and assumption B, that all of this, what would you call it, magical thinking, is based on, that is very, very easy to say is not valid. And as people know, when your assumptions aren't valid, you have to have a branch plan. There's no branch plan. The first assumption of the exquisite assumption A is they want to say that the Navy will grow from 296 manships today to between 398 to 512 manships and unmanned vessels at some unspecified date in the future. The number of manned ships would increase between 321 and 372. Here's exquisite assumption A. The inventory of unmanned surface and undersea vessels would rise from just a few prototypes today to between 77 and 140. As we had a couple of guests on towards the end of the summer, whether you're talking about mechanical resilience, whether you're talking about secure reach-back bandwidth, whether you're talking about legal and ROE issues, et cetera, and so forth, it's not ready for prime time and isn't going to be anytime soon. And the second little assumption there is – The CBO estimates the cost of shipbuilding for that fleet of 398 to 512 manned ships and unmanned vessels, as envisioned in the 2022 plan, would be about $25 to $33 billion in 2021 dollars per year over 30 years, compared with an average of about $23 billion per year over the past 5 years. And they also have a nice little graph on page 6 about large surface combatant forces under the four scenarios. They all decrease down to the force goal of 63 to 65 ships. Yeah, that's about right. What kind of had my eye twitching is, in the likely event that exquisite assumption A is invalid, unmanned systems are simply not going to be able to do that. And your exquisite assumption B, I see absolutely no traction in Congress to increase the budget that much. So we're not going to have, we're going to be default to those large surface combatants, at least inside the Davidson window, being what we go to sea with. And, but even if exquisite assumption A and B play out, I like this quote as well. A key implication of the Navy's plan is that it would reduce the number of VLS cells, which provide the main missile capability on surface ships, but increase the number of manned ships and unmanned vessels capable of carrying them. No, the right answer is we have more ships capable of carrying VLS cells and more VLS cells, because the VLS cells are what we carry the weapons we need. And if you're going to be going against the People's Republic of China, let's look at all the target sets that we have to, quote, service, unquote, as we targeteers like to talk about. You can't do that with fewer VLS cells than we already have, unless you have some magic way of getting more VLS cells underway by 2030. And we need to find some way to mitigate this. And there are a few, and we've talked about them here. So my executive summary of the CBO's analysis of the Navy's fiscal year 2022 shipbuilding plan is, as our friend Brian McGrath likes to say, winter is here. And as I like to say, behold, the terrible 20s are nigh. This is going to be a tough decade. We're going to have to fight and claw every little bit to maintain the capabilities we have, because I think we're being too optimistic on our assumptions. So we're going to have to think hard. We're going to have to think smart. And we're going to have to invest well with what we do wind up with. But going back to what we talked about at the start of the show, if we have the same people in the same organizations coming up with the fleet of 2040 that in 2005 came up with the fleet for 2020, we're in trouble. We need new people.
Yeah. I mean, that's... I'm always reminded of people who, here we go, this is probably politically incorrect these days, but people who want to cut the size of police forces and then complain that there's no policeman on every street corner. I mean, you know, you can, one cop, I don't care how well armed the cop is, if he's in a patrol car, if he's flying in a helicopter, he can only be in one area at a time, covering a certain range. It's all he's got. And it's the same thing with ships. You know, given the constraints on ships, which is you're going to have a 30-year fleet deployed, a 30-year fleet training, a 30-year fleet being repaired or undergoing maintenance. Having 230, whatever is combatants, what are we talking about, surface combatants, 238 surface actual combatants. I mean, whatever it is, it's not enough. We cover too much territory. You know, maybe we can give up roles. We can give up protecting the Persian Gulf or even being in the Persian Gulf. We can give up and let somebody else take that stuff. But, you know, we do have areas that are of vital interest to the United States, and those are the areas we have to focus on, and maybe that's what's required, is a really hard look. You know, if you're going to – and somebody has to shout this. You know, if you're going to reduce the size of our Navy by not funding it, then we're going to tell you what we're going to stop doing. We're going to stop doing Persian Gulf. We're going to stop doing, ops off South America. We just can't afford to do that stuff anymore, but we got enough ships to cover these really important areas, whatever they may be. And I don't know, you know, I don't know who's other than who's going to scream and do that. Everybody, the demand curve right now is for somebody to come forward and go, well, we need more ships and here's why, da, 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 da. But the other side of that is if you don't give me those ships, I don't think this story gets told enough. Maybe it's because I don't read the right things, but you know, if we don't get these ships, then we can't do this anymore. Well, and I don't know what this is exactly, but somebody's going to have to shout that out. You know, this is what happens if you cut this. And you know, we have this this tendency to always think really, well, we're gonna, everything positive glow. We can do. Well, somebody's got to go. Can't do. And you wrote a pretty good piece on that. I think it was on the USNI blog about, you know, the ship that didn't sail. I guess it was a Belgian ship or somebody. They just couldn't get it away because they right. weren't qualified. You know, well, you know, guess what? That ought to be SOP for us. That ought to be our standard operating procedure. And, you know, if somebody's got to stand up and scream, no, I can't do that, and we won't be able to do that until X, you know, more ships or, you know, 6 months from now or whatever. And that I think that's a really important, you know, you hate to be the black cloud, but sometimes maybe that is a job for someone who's, what's the word, gimlet-eyed enough to kind of take that focus.
Yeah, that actually ties into something you said earlier, too. A great secondary byproduct of having a culture like that, and I hope that the Belgian Navy, which I know is incredibly small, it's a nation, only 10 million, and they spend half of, as a percentage of GDP on their military as we do, actually less than half. But because what that does is it has a long-term effect on the abilities of a not just the personnel stuff, but a Navy's material condition. Now, if we want to keep these ships going for more than 30 years, they've got to be in good material shape. Remember, one of the excuses, and in many cases I do call them excuses, for why we sank so many of the Spruances in dark moments after a couple of bourbons, I'll say, it was because they didn't want somebody like me or Jerry writing articles about how we needed to take them out of mothballs. But the Spruances, some of them barely two decades old, were sunk into the ground. They said, well, they were in such bad material condition. Well, all a Tyco is a stretched Spruance. So when you have ships to go, wait, I'm not getting underway for 6 months because here's the following material conditions, which, again, is one of the reasons, and I stand by this, that 10 years ago they stopped publishing inserves and it unclassified, anybody can read it format because of what it said about the condition of our fleet, which actually leaked out a little bit in 2017 with the Fitzgerald and the McCain. But and getting back to centerline there, that would be a good byproduct of that, is if we do need to keep these ships longer, then we need to have a better view on their material condition. Which Tyco was it earlier this year that had to come back because one of their tanks started breaking and leaking all over the place? You know, stuff like that.
Yeah. Even then, I mean, I can't believe that repairing a tank costs more than, or, you know, than a few hundred thousand dollars, $1 million, I don't know, but it's cheaper than buying a new ship. Until you are having, you got to be realistic about this. Don't use those Tycos for the kind of cruises where they need to go, where that stuff, the leak would affect anything. You know, it's not that, to me, it's not that complicated, but then again, I drive, you know, very old cars, so maybe I'm just cynical about it.
And we need to have more people saying the uncomfortable thing, kind of like I've talked about before, and telling people they're wrong. I've had a couple of people reach out to me who are retired military who had the temerity in either their official or their unofficial capacity to write something that wasn't in line with the latest stuff coming out of OPNAV. And they were gruffly talk to as if they were still their prior rank. And, you know, a lot of people telling them to sit down and shut up. But we need more people who are willing to not sit down and shut up and to say the uncomfortable things. You know, perfect example, going back to all the stuff that's floating off of Long Beach and our other ports, like a good little obedient J.O. in the 1990s when the CNO said we needed more people with a business background. While I was on shore duty, I did an executive MBA program. I got an MBA as a J.O. in the 1990s. Yay for me. So in that post-Cold War period, a lot of what we studied was maximizing the micro sense, to use some common terminology, of profit per individual unit by just-in-time delivery of supplies, minimizing inventory, getting the lowest cost solution. And many times it had no impact on the consumer. For instance, a 12-ounce soda can be sold for the same price if it only has 11.5 ounces of fluids in it. The fact that all borders needed to be erased, that if by the time it made it to consumer, you could get 0.05 cents more profit off of an individual unit, even though it was manufactured in China with a sub-assembly in Honduras and delivered here, that's much better than having all the production done outside of Asheville, North Carolina. So let's go ahead and do that. Also, by offshoring, we're going to shore up, we're going to help the peaceful rise of China, because once China becomes capitalistic, they'll become a net positive in the world community. We'll be able to support our other allies. And, you know, we'll find something else for the folks to do in southern Ohio and in the rural factories scattered on railheads throughout the U.S. later. That's what we believed in. That's what we studied. That's what we actualized. So here we find ourselves in 2022 where a little bit due to COVID, a little bit due to labor, a lot to do with both natural and political disruptions overseas, where that whole edifice that our economy in 2021 was built around, because after the fall of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, you know, right here, right now, there's no other place I'd ever be. Everybody sing the song. That future that we thought would materialize didn't materialize. So we need to reassess a lot of our assumptions on how we built our economy and what our priorities are, because that future didn't arrive, and those dysfunctions as a byproduct of that are manifesting themselves under stress. And a couple people smarter than me over the summer have said, hey, let's pull the thread on this. What if, due to conflict or natural disaster, the ships can't sail from East Asia? We're only getting half of the raw materials in Southeast Asia and Africa and South America than we're getting right now. How does that ripple through our supply chain? And that's a real interesting conversation. But a lot of times people don't want to do that because they have invested 20 years of their professional life in this construct that now is getting a little wobbly on the wheels.
Yeah, I actually supply chain management, pretty important stuff, and it's one of those, another one of those unsexy but important topics that we sometimes discuss. I thought it was kind of interesting that the TechNav did approach supply chain management. I think supply chain management in his strategic guidance.
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah. So, but, you know, I don't. There are issues here way beyond just the Navy's problems. I mean, this whole Ross and Sal, the other Sal. I mean, they're really on top of this stuff. You know, how are we going to the danger we face by not having a strong merchant marine, the danger we have by not having an adequate port system that's properly managed. And I don't, Lord knows I don't want the federal government managing the port system, but, you know, it's the importance. If you're going to do this, as you just said, if you're going to do the just-in-time management of your supplies, every business that does that has an incentive to get these ports to operate properly so that they can get their stuff as they need it. And they also have an incentive to, and that works on both ends. They need to get the Southeast Asian ports or the wherever else organized properly. You know, it's worked really well until it doesn't work. And then that's the problem. Now, you know, once you see that how it doesn't work, you know, how do you build a system to protect you from future things like that, like have happened recently? So that I think that's interesting. I thought one more thing I have on the SecNav's guidance. One of the things he puts in there was empowering our people, and he talks about eliminating harmful behaviors, you know, and you know, zero tolerance. This is good. Zero tolerance for sexual assault, sexual harassment, other behaviors. No problem with that. But I'm thinking, when I thought that, I went, eliminate harmful behaviors. How about getting people to sign contracts and not messing with them? I mean, the whole LCS saga is an example of harmful behavior. How about having people take responsibility for decisions they've made and somehow holding them to the standard? I mean, that kind of we're always talking about the message that gets sent down to the deck plates from above, but the examples that have been set by some of the senior management levels, both civilian and military, those are harmful behaviors that somebody should be holding the people to task for this. And I'm not one example, of course, is the scandal involving Glenn Martin, whatever the scandal with the senior people getting kickbacks and bribes in Asia. Fat Leonard, here you go. Yeah, with Glenn, I can't remember the name of his name.
I don't know.
But anyway,
I've been looking for more information on it that hasn't come out, but we may have another Fat Leonard type scandal from the 6th and 5th Fleet AOR that is just now starting to trickle out. I think most of it's under wraps because they are getting the small fish to flop on the big fish, so to speak, but I wrote about it briefly early last week. We have another one of those things, but I think you touched on a good thing. You need, when you have quick, swift, and sometimes you could argue overreaching accountability below, but you have no accountability at all at the highest level. You know, you talk about something that's a negative impact on good order and discipline. We have a few thousand years of military history that shows how destructive that is. But that, again, you know, Secretary Del Toro, he's a senior civilian in the Navy. That he can do that if he wants to on a variety of issues, and hopefully he has an opportunity to do that. And I wanted to bounce back for a second to something you said, because I think we both share – I'm the last person to want to get the federal government involved in everything, but I saw a couple of responses to, I think it was John Conrad, or may have been Sal Mercogliano, who I think I saw the fourth or fifth shout out to Sal. I'm glad he's in the chat room. He can be feeling all the love today. Where people have responded saying, well, ports are a local issue. Ports are a state issue. This is a commercial issue. I'm a firm believer that, and one reason I don't like the federal government getting involved in everything is the federal government cannot do well on the things it should be doing and is designed to do when its interest and focus and effort is doing things it is not supposed to do. When you have a continental-sized nation such as ours that is by nature a maritime and aerospace power, both militarily and economic, and is very ice, just has a few ports on the East Coast and West Coast. I'm sorry, the security and the throughput ability in Long Beach, up in Seattle, Savannah, Jacksonville, Norfolk, up in Newark, that is a national issue. The federal government does need to be involved. It does need to help make it better, unquote, so to speak. Does need to look at larger infrastructure issues, very similar to what the Danes, the Dutch, the Norwegians do. And I'm sure there are other nations in Europe that have a pretty active policy in the maritime arena than we do. Those are just the ones I'm most familiar with. Because they recognize that. If these small nations of 5 million to 20 million people can do that and have such an outsized play on the world, we need to look a lot closer, regardless to what our good friends at the Cato Institute might say, at what our federal government can do to ensure that a maritime nation such as ours has the commercial port and industrial capacity to be able to, should history take an uncomfortable twist or two, be able to function and not have the larger host of our country be negatively impacted because these small little nodes were not properly paid attention to. Again, it's one of the good byproducts of this crunch we're having the good year is this issue is getting more attention. Unfortunately, I don't know whether what you and I would think would be positive attention is winning the day.
Yeah, I think it's just a follow-on to the concept of sea blindness. I think that people, you know, I'll go back. I always pick on people in New York City, but they have no idea where the food that they get comes from, a lot of them. I mean, they, you know, their concept of a farm is Old MacDonald, I guess. I'm not quite sure, but, you know, they don't. The appreciation of how goods get transported, how important containers became in reducing the cost of shipping things. You know, I mean, it was for a while cents on, you know, it was not even full cents, but, you know, pennies on $100 to ship goods across the ocean. You know, it was cheap. It was so much cheaper to produce it cheaper overseas and ship it than it was. And that's containerization. But a lot of people don't know about this stuff. They don't know about things like the barge traffic on the Mississippi River. They don't understand the importance of the port of New Orleans. They don't understand the importance of the port of Houston or the port of Corpus Christi or a lot of the other, you know, the other ports that you've just talked about. They don't know where all the grain that we produce goes when it goes overseas. I mean, it just the concept of this is completely lost on them because they have not studied it and because the maritime industry has done its job so well for so long that it is just one of those things you assume is always going to be there until, like we see now, it isn't. And I'm hoping that at least some level of sea blindness, which includes blindness about the importance of a strong Navy, is going to be raised to at least far higher in people's consciousness than it has been over the last few years.
Yeah, one thing that, which I hope isn't a large factor, but a side comment about the problems on the West Coast ports had to do with union action that's stopping them from flexing. But a secondary issue is unions have a fair bit of influence in this country. And when you look at not all shipyards, especially in the Southeast U.S., a lot of them because of right-to-work states. They're not full union shops, but there are other unions that are attached to it. These are good-paying jobs. A lot of them are union jobs. You would think there'd be a great variety of a constituency of doing this right, but I don't know if there is, because again, these people, they don't come out and join the conversation. I don't know whether we have any econ professors at the Naval Academy or the Navy Postgraduate School or the Naval War College that has done research in this area can actually speak in public and be effective, because that's kind of reminds me of a conversation I had with Admiral Fogo in San Diego about 10 years ago, a frustration of mine that we should have officers who have PhDs in economics on our major staffs that can help make these arguments and talk with lawmakers and their influencers on this basis. But we need to have some way to have this conversation of the economic impact on jobs and taxes for the states that investing and having these robust capabilities that we should have that we don't. We'll have, and we don't have that because at the end of the day, what comes up is Amazon and Walmart. They want to be able to sell their made-in-China items. They want it delivered, and whatever is the low-cost option they're going to do, that constant drive for spreadsheet, balance sheet efficiency is, you know, very similar to the fact of somebody's trying to make an extra 25 cents selling rope that somebody's going to hang them with. Yeah, you made a profit, but guess what? Now you're going to be hung with it. That part of the conversation and that part of the argument we haven't done yet. Some people have, but not enough and not in the right place.
Yeah, I think one of the problems, too, is that the, at least in the Navy, is a lot of the logistics issues are not transparent to the operators because we have a supply corps. And the supply corps does a great job, but by not having line officers cognizant of what it takes to get toilet paper to the fleet, for example, you know, that is that's an issue, you know, and it to me, my older son got a MBA and a combined logistics certificate through a program that the Defense Department did fund for a while, but his certificate was in logistics. Well, that, you know, here's a line officer actually has seen, gone to the logistics thing. I mean, they went to China, they went to Vietnam or someplace to see how that worked on that, and then did some other stuff in this country. So, you know, that kind of knowledge would be really important, I would think, if you were on a staff somewhere, and somebody said, "Well, how, you know, really, what are we doing here?" And not just saying, "Well, we'll get more replenishment ship. That's great," but you know, also, where's all that other stuff coming from? So,
yeah, it's shame when you consider the amount of commerce that rides on the seas, and that we can't make the national security argument in the economic terms as well as we should. Some folks are trying, but it's just not, yep, not breaking above the background noise. One thing we talked about, I just saw what the time is.
Yeah.
Speaking of things that are breaking above the background noise, we do. Right? We'll chat forever. It's been less than 6 weeks since our retreat from Kabul, and those that were saying just hunker down, the news cycle will take care of it, it's amazing how much it's already disappeared from the national consciousness, except in a few isolated places where people are directly impacted. I knew this was going to happen, but I didn't think it would really happen this fast.
Yeah, but you know, they're protecting somebody. The media would be all over this, I think, if it under certain other circumstances. But you know, I confess to a certain degree of cynicism on that too. We also don't hear much about do you know what's going on in Syria? I don't hear many stories these days. You know what's going on in Iraq? It's like the whole cycle of the Middle East is kind of closed down unless something really dramatic happens. I don't know where Afghanistan fits into things, but yeah, I mean the news there is not good. I mean, I last time I heard there was still a whole bunch of California elementary school kids trapped. I don't even know what they were doing there to begin with, but trapped in Afghanistan. You heard anything about that?
No. And there's the most optimistic thing I've heard, there's still hundreds of Americans trapped there. It's just those who make the decision on what's important and what's not have decided that they wanted to throw that down the memory hole.
They've done
really
a good job
to find information on it. They have.
Well, I know we have a We have a couple of guests coming up to talk about that, right, the next couple of weeks. Am I wrong?
Well, we do. No, you're not wrong. Matter of fact, let's see here. We have, I thought I had my calendar up here, but I didn't. Wait, where's my calendar? Here. Okay, got the calendar. That's the great thing about Loja. It's like, here, I'm going to see if you're awake. Next week, we're going to do a little bit of time travel. We're going to have retired Navy Captain Steve Deal, and I can only have his name right in front of me, and his senior enlisted advisor ran a provisional reconstruction team, PRT. The Navy ran a few PRTs in Afghanistan. We're going to have them on for the full hour as a reminder of, you know, what the Army-Navy did and what our goals and desires were in our provisional reconstruction teams. And after spending a year there and having plenty of time to think about it, what type of lessons they may have coming forward next time we get invited to do that. We also have coming up on the 24th, we're going to focus on China with returning guest Andrew Erickson. For those that aren't familiar with Andrew, you're really doing yourself a disservice. He is one of the sharper tools in the shed when it comes to issues with China. So we're going to do a little bit of time travel with a view for what we learned going forward to Afghanistan next Sunday. And then on the 24th, we're going to do a situation report on China today and what he sees coming down the road. So definitely some good stuff for our guests besides just listening to you and me pontificate about what comes across the transom.
Yeah, well, with that being said, we should probably stop and let our listeners go back to do more meaningful things and enjoy the rest of their Sunday.
Absolutely, and Maggie, it was good to see you show up in the chat room along with Paul and Sal and everybody else. Really appreciate y'all coming and joining us for today's Mid-Rats. And until next week, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.